when you have an inspiration, not to let it die, just turn it into an action immediately. When Avraham Avinu took the Malachim under the shade of his tree, HaKadosh Baruch Hu swore that his children will be rewarded by sitting tachas kanfei Hashchina, b'tzila d'mayim nisa, under the shade of the Shechina. The result of that promise was the mitzvah of Sukkah. Project Inspire designed an initiative called Kol HaEzrach, bringing a non-frum person into your sukkah. What greater gift can we give the Ishbizan this year and every year than to emulate Avraham Avinu and bring people tachas kanfei Hashchina? So last night I was talking to my sister, and she noted a tone of anxiety in my voice, as sisters do so well. And she said, "Tzipi, what's the matter? You nervous?" I said, "Yeah, because Project Inspire has this Kol HaEzrach thing, and they want me to explain it to the women, and I really don't know how to do it." So she says, "What's your problem?" You know, when there's a tzedakah party in a mansion, somebody's making a tzedakah party in their fancy renovated home, and instead of just sending in a check, you really want to see the inside of that mansion, so you actually go to the party. I mean, if you're like me. You know, that picture a non-frum person. He's walking through Borough Park, he's walking through Williamsburg, through Flatbush, and he sees these huts of different dimensions, sizes, shapes, colors. They come up, they stay up for 9 days, and they go down. Don't you think he's dying to see the inside? He is. All he's waiting for is an invitation. And if you're still intimidated, Project Inspire to the rescue. They prepared a packet that you can pick up on your way out. And it's designed to help you ease through the experience. And you can also win a trip to Eretz Yisrael while you're at it. The first time I met Lori Palatnik was at the Eish HaTorah convention that I attended 2 years ago. And it was also the first time I heard her tell her story. And I've heard it many times since, and I must say I laugh and cry every single time I hear it again. The next time I had the privilege to be in her presence was this winter at her Chizuk mission, where she took 50 from women from all over the United States to Eretz Yisrael for an inspirational tour. Now, I'm a Beis Yaakov graduate, I'm from birth. I didn't think I needed an inspirational tour in Eretz Yisrael. But Baruch Hashem, Project Inspire, sent me to speak to these women about doing Kiruv, so I joined them. Well, I was in for the surprise of my life. I was sitting there across the Kosel HaMaravi, and if you ever want to treat yourself to something, join this tour. Sitting across in the Eish building and listening to these amazing speakers, and I said to myself, Tzipi Reifer, from birth, Beis Yaakov graduate, you know almost nothing. The next time was this summer when I joined Lori again on her JWRP, Jewish Women's Renaissance Project, where she took 200 non-frum Jewish mothers to Eretz Yisrael for 10 days to introduce them to Yiddishkeit. She's taken hundreds of non-frum Jewish mothers to Eretz Yisrael. And I witnessed the revolution that took place in the lives of these women. And you know, I say it's like, you sometimes hear about sick children, and you know, we know there is such a phenomena, and you can say kapitul tilim, you'll shed a tear, maybe, you'll sigh. And then one day, you visit the pediatric ward, and you come home sick. That was my experience. I ate with them, I drank with them, I shopped with them, I toured with them, we sat in the bus together. It was the experience of my life. I watched them keep Shabbos for the first time. I watched them take challah. I witnessed their longing, their pain, their frustration, face to face. And just being in Lori's presence made such a huge impact on them. And whenever I can be in her presence, it's precious to me. Lori inspires me to reach way beyond what I ever thought was possible and do more. I explained to her in Eretz Yisrael that I'm just, so far, the only Hasidish lady that's doing, you know, this kind of training, and the attitude in my community is still so not care of minded, and it's not easy. So she just looked at me very matter-of-factly and she said, "Well, you're just going to change your whole community." Remember? Remember? I looked at her like, "What? Me? One person?" Lori is one of those people that can make you see yourself in a whole different light and find koiches you never really knew you had. And let's face it, just like by Yetzias Mitzrayim, just like by Matan Torah, just like by Chet HaEgel, just like by the Meraglim, just like by Benos Tzlachad, Nes of Chanukah, and Mitzvah Shem by Bias Mashiach, it's going to be the women. It's going to be the women. So, now I bring you the woman I call the Sarah Schneer of our generation, Rebbetzin Lori Palatnik.
Take it, unbelievable. She's the coolest Hasidic woman I ever met. Park and you're going to speak, and I'm like, yes, it'd be yes, 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 and here I am. The story I'm going to share with you tonight is very different than any talk I ever give. It's a very personal story. But what I gained from it, and how much it changed me, I want to share that with you, and hopefully you can bring it into your life as well. Because 2.5 years ago, I had the privilege, as you saw on the poster, of donating my kidney to a woman I had never met before. And it was the greatest experience of my life. And I'll explain why. So the whole story started about 6 years ago. I was actually at the time living in Denver, Colorado, working with Eshet Torah, and now we live near the Washington, D.C. area. So, at that time, my husband was learning with a gentleman who's not from, his name was Alan. And one day, and we became close with Alan's wife, we did a couple's mission to Eretz Yisrael, and we became close with them. And one day he said to me, "Do you notice that Alan wears a beeper?" And I was like, "Oh yeah, he does." He says, "You want to know why?" "He's not a doctor." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because he's waiting for a kidney." I'm like, "Oh my gosh. I never knew anyone who, in a situation like that, they're waiting for an organ." So that night, I went on to Rabbi Google, and I Googled kidney transplant, kidney donation, and I just really wanted to know what Alan was going through. And I discovered a lot of things on the sites. Can I tell you before I start this, I didn't even know what my kidneys were. I know they're in there somewhere, okay? They're in your home, they're 2 4-ounce kidneys, and I had a vague idea of what they did, not really. They're filters. They're filtering all the toxins out of your body. And if they're not working, those toxins are staying in your body. So on these sites, first of all, some of them are heartbreaking because there are people on some sites, there are some sites where they are really just like ads for people saying, "Please save my mother, save my brother, save my son, save my daughter, save me." People donate a kidney. And there's also on these sites the sort of the requirements and the structure of what a person could, you know, what are the qualities a person needs, the qualifications to donate a kidney. And I was going through the list, and I was like, check, 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 check. I realized that based on what I was reading, that I'm a very good candidate to donate a kidney. Why? In the kidney world, which I started walking into, it's very blood driven. It really has to be very much based on your blood type. So, is anybody here an O? I'm an O. Anybody an O? Okay, anybody here who's an O is a universal donor. You can give to any blood type, but you can only receive from an O. Is anybody here an AB? AB type? Okay. So ABs are universal receivers. You can receive from any blood type, but you can only give to an AB. Got it? So I'm an O. Does anybody here not know the blood type? It's shocking how many people don't. Okay? Don't get blind. You should be embarrassed. Okay. So I'm an O. So I'm a universal donor. I was like, wow. And also, you know, Baruch Hashem, I'm healthy, and there's no kidney disease in our family, there's no diabetes. All these things can eliminate you from being a donor, or if you ever had any life-threatening disease, and there's many things. And based on what I was reading, I thought I was a very good candidate. And I went to Alan, and I said, you know, I would like to offer you my kidney. And he was very, obviously very touched. So we actually went to his surgical team, and they looked at me, and they said, the doctor said, no, absolutely not. Wouldn't even test me. Why? Because Alan was a big man, and I'm not a big woman. And they felt that my kidney would not sustain his body. And unless there's 1,000% chance that this is going to be very successful, they don't even attempt it. So based on that, and we appealed, and it's like, no, that was it. So that was it. Done. Show. About 6 months later, we moved to the Washington, D.C. area, where my husband is now the executive director of Asia Torah there. About 3 or 4 months in, I get this random email. And the email, the subject of the email was, a 4-year-old Jewish boy needs a kidney. So I click on. And I replied to them, and I said, actually, I think I'm a very good candidate to donate my kidney. And a couple days later, they wrote back, and they said, actually, he's too sick to have the surgery, but would you be willing to be tested for someone else? That was my first moral dilemma. Man we know and love, take my kidney. 4-year-old Jewish boy, take my kidney. For somebody I don't know. And then I thought, somebody knows some. This is somebody's mother, somebody's sister, somebody's friend, somebody's daughter. And I wrote back and I said, yes, I'd be willing to be tested. And I didn't tell my husband. I told him. I begged him. Why did I tell my husband? Because what am I going to worry him for? Maybe this will go nowhere. Like, why bring up a subject that's just going to cause problems? All right? So they faxed me from the kidney transplant clinic at Montefiore Hospital, which is in the Bronx here. And they faxed me the forms. And I had to fill out a lot of history, mostly like medical history. And I faxed them back. And a couple of weeks later, they contacted me, and they said, based on your application, we are now officially accepting you as a possible kidney donor. And now you have to have a lot of medical tests. And a lot of these tests, some of the tests could be done locally where I live, but most of them had to be done at the kidney transplant clinic in the Bronx, because they only trusted their team. Now I have to tell my husband. So I waited one night, he was in a good mood, and I went, Yaakov, can we talk about something like completely different? And he said, sure. And I said, I told him what I was thinking about doing. And I want you to appreciate how great my husband is. My husband said, I saw the forms on your desk. I was waiting for you to talk to me about it. Now, I wouldn't have been so nice, okay? If I could see the forms, I'm like, what are you doing? Okay, like I would wait, like, no. My husband's a very good man. So I told him what I was planning to do, and he did not jump up and down and go, yay, 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 not at all. He was like, well, hold on. We have Esther Shaila. We have to, I want to talk to a doctor. What about this? What about that? Get all these questions. And I said, of course, you should ask a Shaila. You should talk to a doctor, right? Get your questions out. And in the meantime, I started doing the test. Because he didn't say no. He didn't say yes. But if you don't hear no from your husband, you just sort of keep going until you hear no, right? Okay. So I started the test. So what did the tests entail? The first test were just they draw a lot of blood, and they cross-match the blood to these. There were three women that they were testing me for. So a lot of people asked me, the first question people asked me is like, how did I know I was dealing with Jewish people? So the person who sent me the original email, her email address is kidneymitzvah@aol.com, okay? And she happens to be in the audience today. So I knew kidneymitzvah@aol.com, I'm dealing with Jewish people, and then quickly I realized I'm dealing with foreign people. So there were three foreign women that I was being tested for, and they cross-matched. cross-matched it, and based on the cross, based on the cross-match, they said that I actually matched two of them, based on my blood type and all the antigens and all the things that we have to deal with. I matched two of them. So, actually, at that point, I wasn't sure if I was looking for people, but I said, like, can you tell me, like, something about them? Like, you don't really know very much information as you go along. They said, okay, well, one lives in Brooklyn and has 10 children. One lives in Muncie with 7 children. Okay, for that, all right? So now I know I was looking for people. So, and then a lot of the other tests that were done, they basically test you from head to toe to see if you're healthy. You know those medical tests that you know you should do when you kind of push off? They do those tests, all right? So it's actually very good. They actually told me at the clinic that one time somebody wanted to donate a kidney, and they were testing them, they found something wrong with them that they didn't even know they had. And they saved, they couldn't donate the kidney, but by being willing to save somebody else's life, their own life was saved. So here I am being tested from head to toe. And every time I got an offer to speak in New York, I took it. Because the organization would bring me in, I would speak, I'd go to the Bronx for more tests, and this went on for a few months. I told very few people what I was planning to do. Why? Because universally, when I would float this idea out to them, universally I got a negative response. What are you doing? Why are you doing this? Why would you put yourself as you don't do enough? Why would you think about responsibilities? And it was very negative, so I stopped talking about it. Except for one woman. Her name is Rebecca. Rebecca, who is Rebecca? You have to know a little bit of background. So when I moved to 5 years ago to the DC area, so at Ish Torah during the Chagim, I want to say during the high holidays, but I really am wrong, but I speak to non Puma audiences, so if I say something that sounds weird, like, please forgive me. So my daughter, if I get speak at her school, she goes, Eva, please, don't say Abraham or forefather. Traditional service with a lot of explanation, and then parallel to the service, we have a lot of classes and lectures, and I'm one of the speakers, and a lot of people come, and they really come, and they want to stay in the classes, and then we have the shofar blowing for everybody, and we have like a beginner kind of something. We have this whole thing to really bring non-form people into having this experience. So that year, we moved there a couple weeks before Rosh Hashanah, and that year, there was this one older couple who came, that were like walk-ins, and who, because they used to have been there for a while, and they were new people who had tried this for the very first time. But their brother suggested let's do something different, and they came. And they told me later, we've now become very close, they told me later that the whole time they kept saying to each other, because when I was speaking, they're like, Rebecca has to hear her, their daughter, Rebecca has to hear her, Rebecca has to hear her. Who was Rebecca? Their daughter, who was in her early 30s, who had not stepped foot in a shul in a long, long time, they told her after Rosh Hashanah that you have to go to this place, Eish HaTorah, and you have to hear this woman speak, that you're going to love her. And she did not want to go anywhere. So between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, they just kept hugging her and hugging her. So finally, she told me later, just to shut them up, she said, okay, fine, I'll go. So she came, cold injury night. And that night, I gave the talk. There's a talk I give called Soul in the Afterlife, Where Do We Go From Here? Because you just can't even imagine, like what Sippy was saying, how little Jewish people know about anything Jewish. And one thing they really think, it's not a Jewish idea that we believe that something happens after you die, because the non-Jews are very, very vocal about it, and seem to be, especially the secular world, the secular Jewish world doesn't speak about it. And the basis of a lot of people's Judaism growing up, you have to know, is whatever they do, we don't do. Okay? So if they do after them, we don't. They think it's not Jewish. So when you start to tell them that and you walk them through it, I'm telling you, this is just, you can't even imagine. Going to a shiva is always very, very, very sad. But going to has anybody here ever been to a secular shiva? A shiva called a secular? It's like a completely different experience. It's very sad in a very different way. Why? Because it's a party. Alright? That's why it's sad. Nobody knows what to mourn or how to mourn. Nobody knows how to issue a call. And because they think that nothing happens after you die, the mourn is really the most tragic thing, because they think it's lights out and it's warmth and that's it. And it's a very, very heavy thing. So that's, I speak about a lot to give them perspective and meaning to their life. Because at the end, I tell them that what I told you may not change the way that you die, but hopefully it'll change the way you live. Because if you know that what you do here matters, not just for now, but for eternity. All right. So she comes, and she told me she sat at the back, waved to her parents, crossed her arms. She sat at the back because she was going to wait 10 minutes and leave. So she stayed the whole night. And the next Shabbat, she showed up. And after Kiddush, I said, would you like to come back to our house for lunch? We always pick up our guests in our shul. And we have a lot of guests. And so she's like, no, I'm going hiking. Okay, fine. The next Shabbat, she shows up again. And I said, after Kiddush, do you want to come back for lunch? And she goes, no, I'm going to a movie. Okay, every week it was something else. So finally, I put her down. And she finally was like, oh, just to shut me up, said, okay. And she came. She had a great time. My kids loved her. She loved my kids. And we started a relationship. And, we started meeting and learning. And at one point I told her, you don't know who you are. You don't know where you're going. How are you going to make good decisions in life? She said, what should I do? I said, you should go to your Israel. Go to Israel. I said, go to Israel. And I'll set a whole reading program at age for you. And it'll be great. And Shabbat and everything I'm going to set up for you. So great. So she does. She goes to Israel. She has an unbelievable experience. She comes back and she starts becoming frog. So she became, after a while, it doesn't happen very often that a student crosses over and becomes a friend, like a real friend, but she really became my best friend. She was my best friend. Became very, very close. So I told Rebecca what I was thinking of doing about the kidney. And she also was negative. What are you doing? Why are you doing this? You don't do enough. You think you don't do enough? Why would you preach on it? All these things. And I actually said to Rebecca, I don't know why I'm driven to do this, but I really feel very strongly from deep inside that I really want to do this. She goes, okay, I'm not in favor of it, but you're my friend and I'll support you. Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. So that summer, the summer before I gave I had a transplant, that summer I brought a group of women, as Tippi says, to Eretz Yisrael, and we do this whole trip. It's unbelievable what happens to these women. You get them out of their lives. And you expose them to the magic of Eretz Yisrael, and just the beauty and the kedusha and the bonding that takes place, and the classes and the learning and Shabbos at the cook and the age of the building. It's like it's unbelievable what happens. You literally see the neshama bloom before your eyes. It's incredible. And they go back and then they make changes in their lives. So you don't sleep very much on these Mississippi trips. We don't sleep a lot. So you don't sleep a lot, and you're with the women all the time, and they're out late at night. So you spend this whole 10 days, and now we're on the plane back. Rebecca came with me that year, and we're on the plane back, and we're going to stop in New York in order to get the connection to Washington. So I said, will you stay with me for 3 days in New York so I can finish all the tests? She said, yes. So we stopped in New York, and I do remember it was like 3 years ago. It was an August hot, muggy morning that a tornado touched down in Brooklyn. Do you remember that? It was crazy. All right. So that was the morning we landed at JFK. All right. So this is, here we are. We don't sleep the whole time. It's like crazy, especially the last couple of nights. And then we're on the plane, and then you're so sad that you're leaving your stomach, and then you come off, and you're like, all you have to do is have a shower. It's hot. It's muggy. And it turns out this tornado had touched down in Brooklyn, and New York was in chaos, and it was flooding in the airport. And so it took the car service like 90 minutes to even get in to get us, and we get all our overseas luggage in it, and now we're heading out to the hospital, to get to the Bronx, to Montefiore Hospital. And it was, New York traffic is always special, right? This was beyond, okay? Like, I had never seen anything like this in my life. And it was stopping, it took us 4 hours to get from JFK to the Bronx. And stop and go, hot, muggy traffic, was unbelievable. And Rebecca was like feeling sick, and she looked sick, it was awful. And at one point, we're going over a bridge, and she's like hanging out the window, and she looks so mad, and Rebecca, you're making me sick, I can't look at you, okay? So at one point, the driver was Indian, was like, I'm not going on, I can't let you go, I'm going home. Because it was terrible, his car was overheating, and I had to get him to keep going. And I said, I'm donating my kidney to a woman I've never met before. He goes, really? Right? Okay, so now he's still driving. And then he asked me the question that I asked very early on in this whole process. He asked me, he says, like, how could you possibly give away your kidney? Like, well, how can you live? And I said, you can live a perfectly normal, healthy life with one kidney. And then he asked the question that I asked Dr. Greenstein, who's a Shomer Shabbos Jew, head of the clinic at Montefiore Hospital. He asked, then why would God give you two? And Dr. Greenstein when I asked and answered, one to keep and one to give away. So we finally get to the hospital. I was calling the hospital the whole time. I was saying, like, I'm so sorry. I'm like, we're late. They go, all the doctors are late. Everything's crazy here. Don't worry. We finally get there. And the team from the transplant clinic was actually waiting for us in the lobby. And we brought out our luggage. And they took one look at Rebecca. And they go, are you the recipient? There's an apartment hotel nearby where you can stay while you're doing these tests. And they brought me right into the test because we were late. So I was like, test, 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 test. And I kept passing the test. And I was like one of those kids in school, like, always wanted to do well. Like, I was like one of those kids, right? So I like passing tests. The only thing I ever failed in my life was a driver's test. I'm still traumatized by it, all right? So I passed the test. Yay, I'm passing the test. So finally, after the day of test, I go back to the apartment hotel. Now Rebecca looks like a completely different person. She has showered, and she's rested, and she's unpacked. And we're laughing how they thought that she was the recipient. And remember, Rebecca was against this. And I said, Rebecca, you know if you needed a kidney, I'd give you my kidney. She goes, I know. I go, then how can I not give it to this woman just because I've never met her? She goes, okay. Okay, so now she's on board. So now I go back, and my husband, in the meantime, has still not asked the shiver, okay? Like, he's like, denial, this is really happening, all right? So my daughter was going to Turo at the time, and she was working part-time at Rosh Hashiva in New York, and she calls me up one day, and she says, the Rosh Hashiva is here, the Rosh Hashiva is here. And I'm like, Abba has to talk to him, get up on the phone. So she got my husband on the phone, and she hands the phone to Rabbi Noah Weinberg's office. And my husband explained what I was planning to do and asked, is this the right thing? And Rabbi Noah Weinberg said that this is a very big mitzvah and that you should support Lori 100%. And that was it. That's all my husband needed to hear. So part of these battery of tests, they won't just give you medical tests, they have to give you psychological tests to make sure, like, you know, okay, like, why do this? And they're also very careful to make sure that you're not being compensated. It's like a whole thing that's going on here. And they want to make sure that your spouse is positive. So at one point, my husband actually had to come to New York. They need to see the spouse. And the spouse says, yes, I will support this. All right? So they do that. They want to make sure that everything's fine at work, that your boss supports it. Since my husband was my boss at work, so that would be fine too. So, but they want to make sure they protect the donor all the way through. So after this battery was passed, everything was passed, everything. So we sat down, and Dr. Greenstein said, okay, so let's set a date. And that was my next moral dilemma. Because at that point, I was coming back, and we were moving from a townhouse to a house. So I said, well, I can't do it now, so we're moving. And then it was, again, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. I said, I can't do it now, because they need me in the community, and speaking, and whatever, and all the things that we do. And I said, and then it's my daughter's bar mitzvah, and I can't, and all the plans. And then some people book me, like, a year in advance to speak, and I can't just cancel on them after, like, you know, they've been planning this, and they advertise this, and then I felt terrible. I said, here I am. I'm too busy. Here's this woman. She needs a kidney. They decided this one woman in particular was the best match for me, this woman from Muncie. And I'm too busy. And they go, no worry. They protect the donor all the way through. They go, it has to be good for you. Don't worry. We're sustaining her. It has to be good for you. So we decided, based on my schedule and the transplant clinic schedule, that mid-December was going to be the best date. In Kiru world, it's slow time, December, because everybody goes away. So we decided that's going to be it. So we set the date. So now I go back to my life, and I have to start setting up my life, because knowing that I'm going to be away for a while, and then when I come back, I'm going to also be recovering a little bit. So it's not a long recovery, but you have to make sure you have everything's all set up. All right. So 2 weeks before the surgery, I get a phone call, and it's from the clinic. And they said, we told the woman who is receiving your kidney today that she has a kidney. I'm like, oh my gosh, like, what did she say? You have to know, why did they wait until 2 weeks before? Because a lot of people back out. A lot of people back out. You can see why they back out, okay? Like, no one is supporting them with this whole thing. So, and unless I was completely driven to do this, you can see why you would back out. So many people back out that they don't want to give false hope to the recipient. So I said, what did she say? They said, well, she was so emotional, she couldn't believe it. And they said, do you want to speak to her?
I go, yes.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
I had mixed feelings. My husband said, don't speak to her. Why? He said, what if she's not a nice person? She says she's strong, she's a kid, doesn't mean she's nice. What if she's judgmental? What if she's a smoker? He says, you're still going to give her your kidney, but it's going to take away a little bit of the pleasure. He goes, better not to know. But I felt instinctively that I needed more of an emotional connection to this woman to get me through the next few weeks. So I said to them, yes, I would like to speak to her. This is my cell phone number. Tell her she does not have to call me, but if she wants to talk to me, I would like to speak to her. And can I tell you, I left my cell phone on 24/7. This is, okay? 24/6. So one day, 2 days, every time the phone rang, my heart leapt. Like, oh, maybe it's her, and it was never her. Finally, 3 days in, so Wednesday night, and I was walking in to speak at a shiatori. And I'm walking in, and my phone rang, and without looking at it, I was like, hello? And it was her. I'm like, oh my gosh, I so want to speak to you, but I'm about to walk into a class. Can you call me in an hour? She says, of course. So I'm teaching, and as I'm teaching, I'm like completely distracted. And at the end of the class, usually the women want to come up to me, they want to talk to me. And at the end of the class, I was like, class is over, see you next week, bye. All right? I went into my office, and she called, and we talked for 4 hours. The first thing she said to me, she said, Lori, what's thank you? I'm just going to say thank you. And then she asked, who are you? And I said, are you in front of your computer? She goes, yes. I go on to h.com. She goes on to h.com. I said, scroll down, you see there's video blogs. There's one called Lori Almost Live. It's this 3-minute thing I do every week. She clicks on. I go, that's me. And that's what I do. And then we want to know everything about each other's lives. And she turns out we're about the same age, and she's like this high energy person. And it was like, and she told me her story that over a year before, that she was going to get a hernia taken care of, and she went for routine blood tests. And based on these blood tests, when the blood test came back, the doctor said to her, something's wrong with you, because when your kidneys are failing, you don't even know until really it's too late. And they told her that she had a kidney disease and that the only cure was going to be a transplant. So immediately what you do, if you're in this situation, is you put yourself on these lists waiting for a kidney. In New York State, it's a 5 to 8 year waiting list. All right? People die every day waiting for kidneys. And it's a 5 to 8 year waiting list for a cadaver kidney. That means a person has already passed away. And it's much better for a person to receive a live kidney. And it's much better for a person to receive a live kidney before they even go on dialysis. Because going on dialysis only can, a lot of toxins are still, you're getting sicker and sicker and sicker on dialysis. And it's no life. So here she is. She told me she went on the list in New York State. She went to other states to put on the list because they thought it was a shorter list. Everybody around her was tested. And nobody matched her, none of her family matched her, except for her sister. Her sister matched her. But her sister had had kidney problems early in her life. She had kidney stones, and they didn't want to do the surgery. But they appealed, and they found a clinic that would do the surgery. And 3 days before the surgery, they canceled the surgery. Because one of the tests showed that her sister was spilling protein into her urine, and if there's not 1,000% chance this is going to work, they're not going to do it. She said, Lori, when they canceled the surgery, she goes, my sister was inconsolable, my kids were devastated, and I didn't leave my room for a week. And then she got the phone call about me. So again, I had to set up my life a little bit, and you know, carpools and all these, we don't have busing, okay? So carpools, and people were terrific, and people were really, but though I have to tell you, you know, after classes, again, these are secular women I'm dealing with. Like, sometimes a woman will, after class, will be like, can we have coffee? Can we get together Friday and have coffee? And usually, in my world, that means either my husband's having an affair or I just found that I'm not really Jewish, okay? Like, really, that's usually what it is. This is the life I have. So, in this case, though, people were asking to meet me for coffee. It wasn't those two things. They were meeting to try to talk me out of it. Right, to say, I'm here, and they would say, I'm here to talk you out of this. I don't want you to do this. And they would give me all the reasons. A lot of people have misconceptions about it, and that's why they're trying to talk me out of it. And people do, and even my husband had misconceptions. First, my husband says, okay, what happens if you So I said to my husband, first of all, what are the chances that our kids communicating? And if that happens, I hope of my doing what I'm doing, that their siblings will fight who will give their kidney to that sibling. And then, of course, he asked me, other people asked me, what happens if down the road something happens to your kidney, and you need a kidney, and now, like, you don't have a backup kidney, because, well, you only have one kidney. So again, what are the chances of that? And if that happens, this is the best kidney insurance you could ever have. Why? Because the rules and the guidelines at this clinic, and for sure at the one at the Montefiore clinic, the guidelines say that if somebody is a donor and gives away their kidney, and down the road, and it happened once, they said at the clinic, that they needed a kidney, they get the next kidney. You go to the top of the list, you get bumped to the top of the list. But my daughter, my oldest daughter, she's the same blood type as me. I'm O positive, she's O positive. So I said to her, Shoshana, you're my backup kidney. And she goes, okay, but who's my backup kidney? She got a friend and a friend and a friend. So we got a whole thing going on here. No problem. Okay, we're covered. We're good. We're good to go. So the surgery was set for a Thursday. And they wanted me in New York on Monday to be tested. They test you right to the end. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, class, Thursday, surgery. So now it's Shabbos, and everything was set up. The plan was that my husband was going to go with me on Sunday and stay with me, test Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, stay for the surgery on Thursday, and then go back to be with our kids for Shabbos. That was the plan. And I realized over Shabbos, this is not a good plan. Why? Because there's a reason my husband became a rabbi and not a doctor, okay? So if I cut my finger and I say to my husband, Yaakov, can you get me a band-aid to cut my finger? Like, all the blood will drain from his face and he looks like he's going to faint. Like, are you okay? So when I'm giving birth, he is useless, okay? So like a deer in the headlights, like forget it. So I'm like, this is the guy that needs to support me for this. This is not what I need. So I asked Rebecca, I said to Rebecca, I said, will you come with me? And be my, because I want somebody with me to be my support. And she had the kind of job, as long as she had her laptop with her, that she could work, you know, away from the office. And she said she would come. So on Monday Shabbos, I said to my husband, Yaakov, maybe it's better if Rebecca comes with me and you stay home here with the kids. He goes, oh, really? Oh, thank you. So Rebecca and I travel on Sunday, and we travel to New York, and just as we were getting to New York, my phone rings, and it's her. And she goes, Lori, would you like to come for dinner tonight? I'd love to meet you. My husband and I would love to meet you and your friend. And I was like, oh my gosh, yes, for sure. And I told Rebecca, and she's like, look at where that are you. It was like a first date. Like, we're all nervous, you know? This has been going on for so long. So finally, like, we get dressed, and we get the directions to Muncie, and we drive out there. And we heard her husband, and they're like the nicest people in the whole world. You can imagine how emotional it was. And the husband, every time he started to talk to me, because he was trying to thank me, he would start to cry. And I was like, you don't have to thank me. You don't have to thank me. And she made this incredible gourmet meal for us. I'll never forget. It was like this delicious dinner, and she wasn't eating anything. And I said to her, like, why aren't you eating? She goes, well, once you're diagnosed, they put you on a very restrictive diet. You can eat no protein, no citrus, no potassium, no dairy. Like, I'm like, what can you eat? She goes, well, today for lunch I had a rice cake, and for a treat I put a little bit of mayonnaise on it. And she was vigilant about being on the diet when they told her. And they told me at the clinic before I met her, this woman is going to take good care of your kidney. Okay? She calls all the rules. And because she was so vigilant, she kept her off of dialysis. And she was steps, though, towards dialysis. So it was an amazing, beautiful, what can I say? It was a beautiful dinner. And afterwards, she was showing me the pictures, her family albums. And she, in the year and a half since she was diagnosed, she had married off two of her kids. And she was showing me the albums of the husbands. And I'm looking, and you, listen, unless you really knew her, you wouldn't know that she was sick. A lot of people have, you know, there is a kidney disease, but their power's slightly off, but you wouldn't really know. So when at the chasana, she's all dressed like everybody, and the kids and her grandchildren are walking down the aisle, and I said to her, I said, can I ask you, what were you thinking as your daughter, as your, you know, both your daughters were walking down the aisle at the weddings? What were you thinking? Here you are. You know that the only cure is a kidney transplant, and no one matches you. What were you thinking? She said, I was thinking, if I don't make it, she'll be okay. she'll be okay. She goes, I just wanted to live to marry off my last two kids. So we left, and I had my test on Monday. Actually, on Tuesday, I met my surgeon, because Dr. Greenstein is the surgeon who's going to put the kidney into her, but I met the surgeon who's going to take it out of me. And the surgeon told me, she said, Lori, when they're wheeling you into the operating room, you can change your mind. She says, I will tell them I found something medical. And they're not going to know that you changed your mind. Let me be the fall guy. I'll be the heavy. And you have to sign all these papers, like all the cuts for Shalom papers, okay? And all these things that could happen, okay? You sign away. On Wednesday morning, I woke up and I was nervous. I said, for the first time, I said, Rebecca, I feel nervous. And she says, okay, we're going shopping, right? We're going to the city, all right? And we're shopping to distract me. And to really distract me, we decided to take my daughter and her friends from college, Turo, out for dinner, okay? So we pick up my daughter and we're driving to the restaurant. And my phone rings and it's her. I want you to appreciate how great this woman is. She's a very great woman. She said, I go, hi, how are you feeling? How are you doing? Because they're testing her also towards the end. She goes, I'm great. She goes, Lori, I'm calling to tell you, you don't have to do this. I'm telling you, you have five children, you have great responsibilities in the world. With a full heart, I'm telling you, I'll be okay. It's okay, you don't have to do this. Can I tell you? I would never make that call. If it was me, I'm not such a nice person, okay? I'd be at home going, don't change your mind. Like, I would never give the person the out. I said, it's unbelievable that you're saying this, but I'm going to see you at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning at that hospital. You can count on me. So we get to the restaurant, and my phone rings again, and it's her son. She only told her children, after she made that call. Because she said they were so devastated before when the surgery was canceled that she didn't want to do that to them again. So I excused myself from the table, and her son says to me, he said, I'm calling on behalf of all the children, and I just want to thank you for saving my mommy's life because we loved it so much. But can you imagine? This is the world that we're in. So after dinner, we head back, and I called my parents. I really struggled, like, should I tell my parents? My parents are in trouble. Should I tell my parents? Should I tell my parents? Some people said, you should tell them. You'll tell them afterwards, So I decided, I called them up the night before, and I go, and my mom answered. I go, Mom, it's Lori, and I have some news, but I want Dad to get on the other line. I want to tell you together. She goes, what's wrong? I go, no, it's good news. So my dad gets on the other line, and I told them, I said, first, I want to apologize, forgive me, for not telling you until now, but I didn't want to worry you. But I'm in New York, I told them the whole thing, and I'm giving it to this woman who I just met yesterday. And afterwards, I asked my mom, I said, what did Dad say when he got off the phone? She said, he turned to her and said, well, I wasn't expecting that. I called up my brother, who lives in Amsterdam, and I called him, and I woke him up in the middle of the night, and I said, Randy, it's Lori. Okay, this is what's going on. I'm in New York, and I'm giving my kidney to this woman, but here's my name, done for me, done for her. Okay, just done. Okay, kidney, yeah, I've been done. Okay, fine. 3 hours later, he calls me up, and he woke up. What's going on? Okay? So, some people ask me, was there ever a moment where I thought of changing my mind, and there was one moment. The next morning, we got up early, we met her at the hospital, it was me, my daughter, Rebecca, and her husband. And they're prepping us, and the IVs and everything, and they're gonna take me first, because it's gonna be hours of surgery before they're gonna need her. So my husband calls, you know, very emotional, and now the nurse says, let's go. And I wasn't being wheeled in on a gurney. I'm like walking with this nurse, right? With my IV, right? So I'm walking in. And she walks me into a sterile room that leads into the operating room. So we walk into the surgery room, to the sterile room. And she says, okay, are you ready? Right? She's going to open the door. You ready? I go, hold on. I said to her, I have to say a prayer. Because I know I needed to say the Shema before they put me under. But I was afraid once I walked in, I would forget. So it's non-Jewish nurse. She goes, of course, say your prayer. So I said the Shema, and our rabbi always taught us that the essence of prayer is what do you want and why do you want it? So, and that's what we're going into on Yom Kippur. What's the number one thing we ask for Rosh Hashanah is we want his life. And the Almighty is saying, why? What are you going to do with it? So I say to Shram, and I ask, I want her to live. And I want her to live. And this is why, and this is what I'm going to do with my life. And I said, okay, now I'm ready. And she opens the door, and I walk in, and I freak out. I'm telling you, I don't know what I was expecting, but it wasn't this. All right? I thought there'd be a doctor, a nurse, an anesthesiologist, right? There must have been 35 people in this room, okay? It's huge, and it's cold to keep it sterile. And there's these convex mirrors, and everybody's running around with surgical carts and all these machines, and there's this flat steel table with straps that looks like you should do an autopsy on it, and they want me on that table, okay? And I froze. And I said to myself, Lori, what are you doing? And I closed my eyes, and I said to myself, just do it, just do it. And I walked over, and I lay down on the table, and I'm telling you, the next thing I knew, I was waking up in recovery. I have no memory whatsoever of anything whatsoever. So Rebecca apparently was in recovery with me, and I have like vague memories of it. And she said the first thing when I came to, the first person I asked for was for her. I said, is she okay? Is she okay? But she was still in surgery. And after the surgery, when they brought her into recovery, the first person she asked for was me. Is Lori okay? Dr. Louis' son came and saw me, and he said to me in recovery, he goes, Lori, you have a great kidney. She's pitching up a storm. It's unbelievable. It's miraculous. It's like a car that doesn't work, and you take a part from another car, and you put it in that car, and it goes. There's something called your creatinine level that they measure. It's a measure of how your kidney's functioning. You want a low number. 10 means your kidneys are in failure and you're on dialysis. She was a 9 going into the surgery. In 24 hours with my kidney, she was a 1.4. It's amazing. So they brought us both up to the ward afterwards. And I'll tell you, the first 2 or 3 days were not fun, okay? I have to tell you, though, out of 5 children, I had 4 cesareans. I call this my kidney vacation. You know, you have cesarean, they cut you open, they take out the guts, they take out the baby, they put you guys, they give you a newborn baby, they take care of 24/7, all right? So this one is, they do the whole same thing, but then they take care of you, you have nobody to take care of. So I was like, hey, this is not so bad. So the first 2 or 3 days, though, were not fun. I had a bad reaction to the anesthetic, and it was hard for them to get the pain and the nausea under control. It was not fun. But during that time, her siblings, her sisters were coming in to visit me and their spouses, and they brought me these like thank you, drawings for the grandchildren. And Rebecca actually taped one up that said thank you with hearts on it on the wall. And so at one time in the middle of the night, I woke up very uncomfortable. And I was like, why did I do this? And then I saw that picture, and it's like, then I knew why I was doing it. So after 3 days, when they said, well, now you gotta get up and get better. So I took my little pole and I shuffled down the hall to visit her. And she said to me, she goes, Lori, I don't know how to explain to you how I feel about you, but it was like I was standing on the road and a truck was hurtling at me full force, and you stepped between me and the truck and you stopped the truck. So when I tell people this is the greatest experience of my life, some people are actually negative about it. They're like, what? Greater than having children? And I said, yes, really. But first of all, when you have a baby, it's a little bit of a selfish decision. I want a baby. Here's my baby. See my baby? So this was the greatest. You quickly learn, like, you're not in it for what they're going to do for you. My rabbi says, if you're in it for what they'll do for you, get an English butler. They're cheaper. Okay? But the initial desire is really a selfish kind of thing. This is what I want. So this was the greatest and purest opportunity that Hashem ever gave me to just give for the purest giving. And as Rav Dessler teaches us, that it's not I love you so I give to you, it's the more I give to you, the more I love you. And the pleasure of just being a giver is an unbelievable pleasure, really. What else did I learn? Why was it one of the greatest experiences of my life? I have to tell you, that a lot of people were very critical of me. I got a lot of criticism over this, but people were critical of me, like, okay, I somebody you know, somebody like a spouse or a parent or a child, but to give it to a stranger, and I said, like, you know, I have to tell you, it was so much easier for me to give to somebody I don't know. Why? Imagine there's somebody in my neighborhood. There's actually somebody who knows, like who I grew up with. Her name is Ruth. And imagine, God forbid, Ruth needs a kidney. And I say to her, well, take my kidney. And I give her my kidney. Now it's 6 months later. And I'm flying to LA to speak. And I call Ruth. I go, Ruth, can you come to my carpool this week? I have to go to LA to speak. She goes, actually, I'm here this week. I can't have your carpool. What am I thinking? I gave you my kidney. You can't have my carpool. Okay? It creates this unbelievably imbalanced relationship, all right? It, like somebody owes me. I don't like imbalanced relationships. I don't want somebody to feel they owe me. Take my kidney. Be healthy. Have a good life. Because it's a hate. Maybe you don't owe me anything. So, I hung out at home for a while. And 4 weeks later, I was speaking in Houston. 6 weeks later, as if it never happened. And there are certain things I have to remember. I remember I had one kid. Don't join the NFL. Don't go bungee jumping. All right? Stay hydrated. But otherwise, really, she has to be on immunosuppressive drugs for the rest of her life, and she has to be monitored. But Baruch Hashem, she's doing great. She's fantastic. She can eat whatever she wants. She has a healthy, healthy life. The pleasure, if you only knew the pleasure. Time went by, and I was invited to her daughter's wedding. But of course, I traveled to Muncie for the wedding. The pleasure of seeing her dance with her daughter at her wedding that I had, it's like no amount of money could you ever offer me to trade for that. When they were leaving the chuppah, this woman broke away from everyone and came into the crowd to hug me. So this all happened in December, and the next Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, rolls around. And at my house, I'm sure at your house too, it's crazy. Imagine a house where it's even crazier, where like, we have so many beds in our house, with so many people sleep over. We have one room called the dorm room. Like, it was a family room. We took out all the furniture, we put in beds and mud beds, and we have called shabbatons and all these things that we do. So every bed was taken, and people were coming in. I'm speaking to very classes, and I'm cooking for all these people, and it was crazy. And so at one point, and the phone was ringing. I wasn't even like answering because I couldn't get everything done. And finally, the phone rings, and I see that it's her. And I answer it. I go, hi. And she calls me regularly. We come talk like at least once a week, sometimes twice a week. And she calls, and I'm like, hi, I'm so glad you called. Good afternoon. How are you feeling? She goes, Lori, I'm calling to thank you for my life. Last Rosh Hashanah, I was davening for my life. What was the greatest thing I learned from this? You know, people make a big deal of the fact that I did this. But what's really greater? What I did for this woman, or what I did for Rebecca? For this woman, I gave her life in this world. But for Rebecca, a girl who was living a very, very non-Jewish life, who is now married from living in Toronto, expecting her first baby, she had eternity. There are times, it made what I do for a living, okay? The work that I do in Kiruv, it exponentially, the impact that I feel and the intensity of wanting to do it so much more. There are some times I'm at a function or I'm at a grocery store, and you meet somebody that's Jewish and they're secular, you know, and they give you their card, and you think, like, oh, I'm going to invite them. Like, you lose their card, or you feel uncomfortable later, like, invite them, embarrassed, or whatever. If you knew you were going to save their life, would you lose their card? Would you be embarrassed to invite them? So somebody told me before I went for the surgery, somebody came up to me at a function, they go, Lori, I heard that you're going to give your kidney to a woman who you've never met before. Is this true? And I said, yes, it actually is. She goes, Lori, because of what you're doing, I'm not going to give somebody my kidney, but I am going to be more of a giver. Can I tell you, you know they have the Sukkot program? Sukkot is the greatest Kiruv holiday ever. Why? Because a lot of times it's hard on Shabbos and Yom Tov and driving and all those. It's not so easy. But here we have Holomoy, and this year's a big Holomoy. And these people, usually they're doing something for Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and some sort of Seder, their version of a Seder. But can I tell you, they don't have a Sukkah. writes and the singing.
They love it.
They love service. They love to come. They love to come with their kids. They love it. When you invite somebody to your sukkah, this sukkah, and I hope you sign up for it, and I hope you sign up for these jewel training seminar, and because they come and they show you, just like people have all these fears and all these misconceptions about my kidney transplant, people have a lot of fears and misconceptions about Kiru. And if you just have basic tools and information, you could give people eternity. Well, Sippy, you're right. I got to come to Borough Park after all. Thank you for that.